as a child of the golden age.
Again, for listening to Rose City Native Radio, you can always look at us on Facebook, and we are here on KBOO.FM. Again, thank you so much for tuning in this week. I'm going to leave you on with a song here by Superman. Have a great day.
Hope you know I never wanna see you go. I hope you know you've always been the one. I hope you know I'll never break your heart in two. I hope you know there's no one else like you.
I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Yo, you know what I'm saying? Listen, if you want to listen to something that's going to stimulate your brain and stimulate your mind, you know what I'm saying? Yo, listen to Hard Knock Radio, you know what I'm saying? Listen, I used to be a new jack, but now I listen to Hard Rock Radio, and it makes me so much better, you know what I'm saying? That's why it gave me power, you know what I'm saying? Yo, you know what I'm saying? Yo, and when you listen to people that have dope stuff to say, you get yourself a body count, you know what I'm saying? Listen. And you can listen to it in your car. Your car could be different colors. You know what I'm saying? So anytime I'm at the house, you know what I'm saying, I want to listen to something like this, listen to Hard Knock Radio before a great episode of Law & Order SVU. Yeah.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to check in with our congressional rep. I don't know if it's the 9th district still or the 11th. They keep changing the numbers. But it's historically been the 9th district. She succeeded our current mayor, Barbara Lee, who held the seat down for a couple of decades. And before that, Ron Dellums. Thank you. I want to say Ron Daniels, who is also very well known, but Ron Dellums, may he rest in peace. And so Latifah Simon has been filling those big shoes, and you come into Congress in probably something that is historic with what is going on. I don't know if democracy has completely been annihilated, but you're one of the few people that I've seen who has been willing to speak up and not bite their tongue. We tried to get you last week because in the middle of this, you were on the floor at the time with the passage of this big bill. And that's all I'm going to call it. They want to put beautiful, but it's an ugly, insidious type of thing. And from your standpoint now as a congresswoman, what absolutely do we need to know to fortify ourselves about this bill? Is there anything on the horizon that is happening that we should be pushing to help you all with, you know, in those legislative seats that you hold?
That's right. So, David, it's so good to be on with you. You know, we've been working together in community for over 25 years, actually 27. We were just talking about it a second ago before we went live. And I cannot tell you how much I love being in this dome here at this particular time, because you know, since I was 18, full time, I've been organizing and working with our beautiful, beautiful Bay Area folk, from everything from housing to criminal justice reform to police accountability. I've even worked, as you know, I've worked in law enforcement. I ran a program at the district attorney's office. You know, I worked on the streets and jails and prisons. And so now I'm here bringing all of those folks, you know, with me every single day. So one thing I want to say before I tell you about this big bill: redistricting happens every 10 years across the country, like right after we do the census. And what the states do, every state, including California, when the census is taken, then there's a redistricting commission for different counties in the state. And then they change, oftentimes the populations change, and so the lines are redrawn. So this district is now the 12th congressional district.
It's the 12th, right?
And in the shift, we lost some cities. So Miss Lee had, she had San Leandro, she had Contra Costa County. We didn't have San Leandro. We picked up San Leandro. We picked up a couple other cities. So I have 7 cities, and wow, it's just been a gift. So I want to go straight into what this bill does. And you all know you've heard some of the talking points, but what my office will continue to do is not just give you the Democratic line. We're always going to give you the truth. The Congressional Budget Office has been very clear. That's a nonpartisan office. That's not Democrat, that's not Republicans. They are budget people. So what the bill does, according to the Congressional Budget Office, it cuts more than a trillion dollars from healthcare. Healthcare alone, so that's Medicaid, affordable healthcare, remember we called it Obamacare, Affordable Care Act subsidies, and children's health insurance. That's the CBL saying that, not me. It removes healthcare coverage from 17 million people by 2034, and it will in fact cut people's food stamps. We call it SNAP now, but we grew up calling it food stamps. That's including folks in the Bay Area. It has defunded Planned Parenthood. Like, that's not going to happen like in a year, like the other things that I'm about to tell you. Like, I'll talk about when Medicaid will start tapering down. The attacks on Planned Parenthood, including the Planned Parenthoods in our district, that's immediate. Over $90 million of cuts from our local Planned Parenthood. And you got to know, Planned Parenthood, only 10% of what they do is abortion services. And the federal government and this administration knows that. In fact, they are literally kicking women. They're kicking us in our necks. Planned Parenthood is a first-rate healthcare center. We actually have the biggest one in Oakland. It's called the Barber Lee Health Center. And the federal government has all but defunded it. It increases, and then we should get into it, the federal budget increases the federal budget for the Department of Homeland Security and ICE by 19%. 19%, sisters and brothers and siblings, equals $150 billion. What you have been seeing before the last couple of weeks, that was with an existing budget. Can you imagine ICE now having $150 billion more dollars? Now, the big ugly bill made ICE the single largest federal law enforcement agency in the country. So not only that, you know, the funding for ICE is now higher than what most countries have, right? In terms of what they spend on their full militias. So it is absolutely devastating. Lastly, I will say, with all of that, with funding unconstitutional acts on our communities, disappearing folks, taking babies away from their childcare centers, sending babies with cancer back to their countries of origin that they've never lived in past 1 year old. We've seen that all. This bill adds $5 trillion in tax cuts to the wealthiest folks in this country and to corporations. And it increases the Pentagon spending. This is what we're dealing with this week, by $1 trillion. So listen, It is absolutely time to dig in.
So when you give numbers like that, I think they're so large that we don't really know what it means. And people cavalierly, you know, say, well, you know, we've always had hard times. This is just another one of them. I'm more concerned about a couple of things. One, the immediate effects. Yeah. You know, you talked about what's going to be happening with the defunding of SNAP, you know, and food stamps and all that, but also Head Start and things like that. It's like they're creating a situation where people are going to, they're not going to have any more safety net. And I don't know what is being done to replace it. And you sitting in Congress, I mean, when this is brought up to people, what do they say? I mean, they just like, well, you know, tough noogies, or well, do they try to give you some sort of,
no, it is. So here's the deal. And I want folks, if I say nothing else, being in the United States Congress right now, every single day I'm in the dome right now, it's sitting up close to an administration that does not care about you. There's no way to, you know, provide canon or an analysis. What is clear is the administration wants this country whiter and more male. And I will tell you, in the district, and let's talk about timeline, in the district, because of the big, horrible, ugly bill, an estimated 35,000. You think of an arena, a big soccer arena, that's only like 25,000. 35,000 people in our district, that's Oakland, San Leandro, Alameda, Berkeley, and Albany, will lose their health care. in 10 years, there's a gradient of how they will be sort of slashing healthcare. That includes 11,000 people who will lose their Affordable Care Act plans. 23,000 of those folks will be cut off Medicaid, and under 41,000 will see their premiums go up. 9,000 families in our district could lose their food stamps. We know they're going to slash them in half. What's important in terms of their timeline, and these folks are straight up evil, what they've done is they've said, okay, well, as soon as Trump is sworn into office, he's going to begin pushing these executive orders that try to, one, fire federal employees. They've already fired 100,000 to make the social safety net weaker. So you try calling Social Security today. This is before the big ugly bill. You're going to be online. Used to be online for 5 hours. You're going to be online for a lot longer than that. Please call my office if you're having those issues. If you're trying to figure out what's happening with your Medicaid or Medicare in real time, you're going to have a hard time figuring that out. Consumer protections have been gutted. The thing that's the craziest, Davey, is that the Medicaid cuts and the Medicare cuts are scheduled to go into effect in November of 2026. Right after the midterm. So folks, we can and we will. We will bite back, right? And so again, all is not lost. It is scary. They passed legislation that is already having a tremendous effect on us right now. What I'm most nervous about is really this infiltration of government actors in our communities who we believe are not following the Constitution or the law, really. The Constitution is the law. And that budget went into effect, right? So with ICE wanting to hire 10,000 more agents, that's right now, right? That is right now. And it's not just one community. We're talking about diasporic communities. Listen, in the Bay Area, in my district alone, we have an amazing Ethiopian population. We have an Armenian population. We have a Haitian population. We have folks who have come from all over the world. In fact, we speak 150 languages in this district, the most progressive and diverse district in the country. If you think that this bill and that the actions of Trump is only targeted against one particular group of people, if we don't do what we need to do, these horrors will reach us
well,
all.
Well, we've done a few shows, and we were pretty intentional because we were disturbed when we started seeing videos, which I tell people were being artificially amplified, you know, with some of these actors. Meaning like the people on these social media outlets.
Yeah.
I say Free Palestine, and we're shadow banned. You get on here and say, don't help these Latinos. They deserve what they get. Oh, it goes viral, and it didn't violate any terms of service. That's so right. We talk with folks in the Asian community from here in LA, and we talk to Haitians in many places around the country, and they've been swooping them up and putting folks in buses, probably in larger numbers, especially with Haitians, but it's not being shown.
Have to talk about it.
This leads to a question around the sort of, is there any sort of strings that you all in Congress can do to rein them in? I think people are anticipating, like, well, we can do things on the midterms, but are we even going to have those? You know, there was stuff in the bill that said that they can overrule elections and all this other stuff. I don't know what that means or what the chatter is, but that seems to be of concern. And what's the contingency plan if the midterms, either one, don't happen or don't turn out the way we want? What can be done to the runoff when you have ICE indiscriminately sending people all over the place?
You know, Davey, I hate the answer that I'm going to give you, right? Because I feel like, you know, on all sides, folks are being gaslit. If you understand that we have lost I'm a Democrat, so I will say it with political, with the big P. We have lost the House, we have lost the Senate, we have lost the presidency, and some would say that we lost the judiciary. So for a country that was already a thinly veiled democracy, I would say we are in trouble. The levers, let me just tell you what it's like here. So just in a couple of hours, I'll go onto the House floor and I'll vote. And what I'm doing, and folks need to know what I'm doing, is every single day pushing, voting no on all the things that they bring forth, right, that harm our communities. it's important to know that even in the oversight capacity, I'm on the oversight committee, that when we don't control the House, we don't control the investigatory power. We speak up, we push back, but we don't have subpoena power. I am 100% committed to showing up here every single day, which I've been doing, coming early, leaving late, working with, unfortunately, sometimes I have to work with Republicans and Democrats. We are a body to try to move smaller pieces of legislation. We're trying to, as Democrats, do a bit of harm reduction. But I will say, showing up to immigrant detention centers, which has been extremely important that members of my party have done, we are shining the light on what these things look like. They want us to see this stuff in the ways in which they want to articulate it. No, we have to shine the mirror of the truth. I think it's extremely important, one, for folks who are listening, engage with your local, state, and federal electeds, me being one of them, work with your community organizations, continue to provide mutual aid to folks. But here is the deal, we have to win the midterms. Or some would say that we will not have a republic, right? It is that serious. When you see, Davey, the clear racism, the homophobia, the transphobia, the anti-immigrant vitriol here, you will realize this is not a game. We're not fighting bad Democrats like we fight bad Democrats in the Bay or in the state of California. We are fighting for folks who have every right to be here and move through an immigration process. We are fighting for folks like the young people that I know that are getting cancer treatment right now at Oakland Children's Hospital, but the federal government has decided to cut NIH funding for their clinical trials. And we look at these folks across the aisle, they do not care. And so there's no rallying racist who could care less about you or your child's humanity. If you believe, regardless if you're super left and radical and or if you're a little bit centrist, like my Uncle Joe, I do believe that the most critical thing we can do, one, to stay involved, and if you have the right to vote, you can actually fire people and bring people in, regardless who's listening and where you're listening. The vote is extremely important. And so many of us have lost faith in that system, but I gotta tell you, it's what we have. And we lost this bill fight by 4 votes. 4 members of Congress, if they would have come over on the Republican side and did the right thing. So if we can win 4 more seats, 5 seats on the Democratic side, we will be able to resurrect what wasn't perfect before, but we'll be able to shoot all this stuff down and try to resurrect some of the social safety net that these folks are trying to take away every single day. And they're doing a damn good job of it, I will say.
Congresswoman Latifah Simon is with us. A couple of things. Let me give out your number, because you said call your office. So it's 510-763-0370. Again, 510-763-0370. And also we can reach you at Simon. That's simon.housegov. So simon.housegov. I want to ask you, because we were talking about taxes and money, you know, money that's being cut and money that isn't. This is our money.
Yes.
We pay federal taxes.
Yes, you do.
And is there a mechanism where if I give you money, what gives them the right to say, we're going to take this money and move it in another direction from the needs of people that are like, look, I'm giving money because we need to make sure that there's a safety net. I didn't give money for you to take away that safety net. I didn't give money so that you can booster up a police force called ICE. If I'm going to do that, I might as well do it locally. At least I have some sort of control over it locally. But you're doing this, and
Davey, you know, you want me to say you don't want folks to file their taxes? Listen.
No, I'm not saying that. 19-year-old
might have said that. But as a member of Congress, I actually need folks to be able to have Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
What folks must do, honestly, like the beauty of this country still, is you still get to challenge and hold accountable your representatives. Everyone that you vote into office, even if you didn't vote for them, their job, including myself, is to represent you daily on the House floor, to go and rally and lobby other members of Congress to say, get it right. This is a fight of our lives. And you literally have the opportunity to call. You can call my office every single day. Our staff pick up the phone. We hear every single one of your concerns. We talk about them. We figure out how to draft legislation. Listen, I already passed two bills. I have four more in the hopper. I put forth six amendments to this horrible bill. Again, we don't have the numbers, so those bills got shot. I mean, the amendments got shot down. Push your elected officials to do their jobs. Now, we, as folks who live here, again, particularly folks in the Bay, we know that not one right was ever given to us, right? When in the words of Grace Lee Boggs or of Malcolm or, I mean, of Wanda Johnson, mother of Oscar Grant, you have to fight and be persistent for every single concession so that you and your people can be human here. I have a flag in my office because, you know, I got to hold that flag accountable every single day. We got to keep fighting, Davey.
I hear you.
It's not over. It's not over. It is absolutely not over. In this country, we still have the right, while they're trying to take it away from us, to protest and dissent. We still have the right, for the most part, for folks to vote. We have the right, literally, to challenge in the circuit courts what is unconstitutional. And we have organizations like Democracy Forward and others who've been known in the ACLU and Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law to challenge historically racist and unconstitutional precedent. So we're just, I think as a collective community, I know that every day I'm still inspired by the fight while I hear the voicemails and read the letters and on my own phone, answer the calls of folks who are fearing for their existence. I'm excited every single day to fight for them. And you know, I'm a faithful person. I pray a lot. I believe that injustice can't stand forever.
No, I hear you. Can't last forever. Congresswoman Latifah Simon, a good friend, we're going to let you go because I know you have other stuff to do. We'll be back in touch. Just the takeaway is that, you know, you keep fighting and keep fighting in every way which you can. And also, just for the record, I wasn't saying not to pay your taxes. But
I know,
I was saying,
joking, Davey.
But seriously, what I do want to say, because we talked about this a long time ago, you know, when Barbara Lee was talking about having a peace dividend, you know, so your taxes went towards peace versus war.
That's what we're
working on. Do we bring something back?
That's what we're channeling on the floor every single day this week as appropriations, and that fight continues. We're going to be talking about our tax dollars. You send me to Congress, so I am saying and advocating, and we'll be screaming from the rooftops, our tax dollars need to go to diplomacy, peace, food, literally childcare, education, opportunities, and accountability for our folks, full stop. That is what your tax dollars should be paying for, and you have representatives in the House who are going to be pushing forth that lexicon. It's what we deserve. It's why you're paying into the system. Love you, Dave.
Latifah Simon, thank you. Love you, too. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Up from the ashes, born of struggle and pain. In the shadows of the past, we won't be held in chains. Our ancestors' blood it calls for justice, for the truth. We march with the spirit, lighting up the darkest room, fighting for black revolutionary freedom. We won't stop until we see the light. Fighting for black revolutionary freedom. We stand united claiming our rights.
Freedom. 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 Black revolutionary freedom.
Greetings, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to this special edition of Rootwork. Here we're doing a special in conjunction with Cooperation Jackson. We are presenting the Build and Fight formula, and we do that, we go through this series of steps showcasing what the Build and Fight formula is. with its primary architect, Kali Akuno, co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome to the show, Brother Kali.
Good to be back for, what's this, episode 5 of The Run?
Number 5.
We really got a special treat tonight, and for those who'll be watching this video or listening to it on other venues afterwards, for those of you who may be listening, I would definitely encourage you to check us out at Jackson Rising and Black Liberation Media, because you will want to see the visuals and want to check out what Blair is putting down. So definitely check it out and sit back and enjoy. Open your mind, listen and learn. There may be some things you will be challenged with. I'm going to say that off the top. I know myself, as we get into it, in my early days of learning about digital fabrication, I'll put it out here now because I know Blair will be dealing with it a bit later, about this method of production being something that will be used to replace black labor in particular. And so I had a serious kind of fear and consternation towards it, but it was Blair who really changed my particular perspective and worldview on it. And I'm quite sure he's gonna do the same for many of you all tonight. So definitely happy to have Brother Blair Evans with us with Insight Focus for y'all to really get a deep understanding of what community production is and how it not only relates to this build and fight formula we've been trying to put out there, but how it's a central piece. I would say perhaps the most transformative piece to it. So, you know, I'm gonna just, we'll lay it out. Y'all in for a treat.
So, Brother Kali is referring to Blair Evans, who is a special guest presenter on tonight's show, The Build and Fight Formula, specifically around the area of community production. Let's bring Blair on now. Thank you so much for joining us, Blair.
Glad to be here.
Currently a resident of Idlewild, Michigan. That is Michigan, is it not? Blair Evans is a leader in the People's Network for Land and Liberation and is a principal representative of the Idlewild node of the consortium and serves on several local and county boards in planning and development. Blair is a member of the board of the FAB Foundation and is founder and director of Insight Focus, a production and training lab focused on relationships between digital fabrication, permaculture, experiential learning, and appropriate technology. As I was saying to you, Blair, backstage, I abbreviated heavily your bio. He's a bunch of other things and doing a bunch of other things. Hopefully he will get into that more as we talk this evening. So again, thank you, Blair, for being on the show.
It's an honor.
Now, in the beginnings, when we talked about this build and fight formula, which was months ago, y'all go back and watch the videos, we made reference to something known as the People's Network for Land and Liberation. We haven't really gotten into it until now. So Blair, why don't we start with you and you let our audience know exactly what is the People's Network for Land and Liberation?
Thanks. The you know, that kind of harks back a little bit to your, you know, I got a resume that includes a lot of stuff on it. And the People's Network for Land and Liberation is about integrating a lot of different concepts that are normally siloed into organic whole, so we can actually get the benefits and the synergy of everything going on. And so there's 6 different locations around the country that are all deeply committed to this kind of build and fight formulation, solidarity economy, asset-based community development, however you want to, whichever lens you want to look at it through. There is a program that everyone has agreed to, but you have 6 individual organizations who are each doing a locally tuned, locally relevant version of standing this up, which means it's very different. The ecologies are different, the social structures are different, the rural versus urban is different, et cetera. But everybody has the same strong core beliefs. And so we adopted a structure as a consortium because we're not you know, all trying to micromanage what everybody else does, but we're trying to come together and aggregate our resources and our knowledge in a way that we can all move farther together than we possibly could individually. And everyone's kind of coming at it from with the new areas of specialty, in addition to trying their best to become a generalist in all of the aspects of what's going on. And my area of kind of specialization is in community production, digital fabrication, kind of some agile project management and that kind of thing. However, I'm deep in the mix of standing up community land trusts and worker co-ops and you know, different types of governance structures and the organizing part of it. It's a extremely rewarding and extremely challenging process because nobody's whiteboarding this stuff. Everybody's on the ground trying to figure out how to make this actually work day to day. And you can find a lot of examples of two or three or four of the components together, but the magic will really happen when all of them can be stood up in the same place at the same time. And so that's what everybody kind of in the consortium is committed to doing. And we're kind of sharing our knowledge to be able to make that happen. That would be my kind of quick overview.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. Now, before we get into your presentation, I want to switch up for just a second. Mm-hmm. Ali, we've had you. You are no stranger to Black Liberation Media, to Rootwork. If you could just briefly refresh our audience's memory, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, does have a community production center and a fabrication lab. What is that and why is that?
The why I'll speak to, and to put it in no uncertain terms. Mm-hmm. For us, this was a way that we saw that we could own and control the means of production on a local level. That is why we chose to kind of pick this particular method of doing production up, and wanted to get ahead of a profound curve that digital fabrication is in. And, you know, we wrote an article some years back called trying to remember the exact title right now, but it was a digital fabrication divide, trying to get ahead of the digital fabrication divide. And that laid out very specifically, you know, for us, the particular role that we have to ensure to make sure that Black working class people, who constitute the overwhelming majority of the people in Jackson, Mississippi, would not be left out of this development, similar to how we were left out of the critical advances of the second industrial revolution around technological revolution around things going from analog to digital, which created the whole kind of internet revolution, if you would, and which created this big digital gap, which in a place like Mississippi still exists and is still profound about who has access, how well their access are, just to the basic internet and the functions of the internet. And how that has rearticulated our world and how it functions over the last 20 years. So we are trying to, we see and have experienced, you know, how that rolled out and it left large part of our communities out. And now having that experience and understanding this technology rolling out, coming online and particularly making some critical advances really since the beginning of the 2000s, like 2003, I think, Blair, correct me if I'm wrong, is when the first Fab Lab, you know, got up off the ground. So that's only about 22 years ago.
And let me just riff a little bit off of what Khalid was saying about his initial concerns about automation. Mm-hmm. And digital fabrication is a means of automation. And automation has displaced a tremendous number of people from the roles that they had in society, the means of earning a living that they had, et cetera. And it especially hit hard in our communities. And one interesting thing about this is that that equipment, which had the leverage and the power to not require a tremendous amount of labor to get the benefits, is now inexpensive enough that we can purchase it and make it ourselves and embed it in our communities to not have it working against us, but to have it working for us. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way of thinking about what this kind of transition is about. And so there's a couple kind of leading slides here and just kind of framing this in the context of a solidarity economy. And this isn't an audience that needs to be convinced that we're in a time of polycrisis. We do have an opportunity to move into a context of local resilience and self-provisioning. Mm-hmm. And that's a major part of what this is about. Being able to have control to provide the things that you need for yourself eliminates a tremendous amount of manipulation that occurs from the outside. And we know what it's driven by. And part of the ability to actually be able to produce for yourself is having the supply chain. You know, you can have a wonderful set of tools, but if you don't have the raw materials to be able to produce with, you're also sunk. And so one of the interesting pieces about this is having the ability to create the things that you need based on the things that you have. And so that local control of local supply chains is also a critical ingredient. You know, in the context of solidarity economy, the point is to give people just kind of an idea of the fact that we're not just talking about producing widgets, but, you know, to have embedded institutions, you know, based around permanent structures like community land trusts, but to be able to fabricate things like housing. A significant part of community production isn't just a digital fabrication, which focuses on the built environment, but also using natural systems to produce the things that you can get from the what would normally be considered an agricultural context component, which includes being able to grow things for energy, grow things for fiber, building stock, food, medicinal components, et cetera, right? And to operate those in the context of democratic decision-making and distributed wealth creation in co-ops and the like. And it tends to, when it's in place, since people can come in and actualize their ideas, it tends to be a place where people come together to co-create, whether that's art, whether that's those are cultural artifacts, and to share experiences and teach each other also. So that's what the educational space component is about. There's a number of components of this whole solidarity economy piece that we can talk about, but what I want to focus the slight majority of the time on is what's unique about this and folks have less familiarity with, which is the digital fabrication. And so this is a kind of traditional presentation. And so this is slightly small, but on the left-hand side, you know, you can see the evidence of the crises that folks are dealing with and try to ignore, which are, you know, very polluting and waste-generating methods of doing things, which are, you know, used to say it's eliminating the potential for, you know, our children and our grandchildren. But the bottom line is diminishing, if you're 20 or 30 now, it's diminishing your capacity at, you know, when you get into your adulthood. This is happening very rapidly. We also have, you know, lack of social support systems, and we have this kind of disposable concept around things. And it's not just like stuff you buy at Target, but it's also like buildings that you build and then move out of and go to someplace shiny while it's still got 20 years lifetime in place. The framework I like to use in thinking about this is kind of donut economics, which is that framework on the right. And in case folks are not familiar with it, it's just a simple way of saying that we have to satisfy our needs and we have to live within our means, right? So we have a set of things that should be a social floor that everybody is entitled to. Important. And that's water, you gotta have air, you gotta have social structures, you have to have fairness, you have to have several other things. And the kind of red areas to go on the inside is the extent to which we're deficient in those areas, that we're not providing a minimum social floor to people in those dimensions. And then the outer green area has to do with planetary boundaries. And the red that's coming out of the outside are those planetary boundaries that we're actually overloading.
Let me see if I can, let me see if I can do this real quick. So the light green with on the within the things that we all need, such as energy, water, food, health, education, peace and justice, political voice, social equity, gender equity, housing, etc.
Right.
And here in the red, we have biodiversity is less, land conversion, nitrogen and phosphorus flooding, climate change. That's in the red.
And those are all things that we are exceeding the planet's capacity to maintain a balance in.
Mm-hmm.
There are other planetary boundaries also that we need to respect. And so in this kind of graphic, the sweet spot is the light green in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to stay in there so we're not exceeding the planetary boundaries and we are providing the social floor that people deserve. And so the issue is it's really catastrophic if you're not providing for people's needs and using up way too many resources because you're exceeding the capacity of the planet to kind of keep up with it. It wouldn't be half as bad as we were, you know, just exceeding some planetary boundaries, but everybody was having their needs met, or the opposite. But to have both of them out of whack is a pretty catastrophic situation. So kind of moving on. There's
real quick in the white on the outside of this circle, we have air pollution, ozone layer depletion, ocean acidification, chemical pollution, and freshwater withdrawals. All of these impacting.
Yeah, those are other planetary boundaries, which as of the time of this analysis, were not being overshot. We're still using them, but we're not using them faster than they can regenerate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those areas on the outside, whether they're red or white, are the planetary boundaries. The ones that are in red are the ones that we are overshooting.
Right? Gotcha. Okay.
And so, the next one is just a specific example. You can break this down more and more, and you can have local effects of this, and you can have kind of global effects of this. And we don't have to dive into that. But my point is that it's actually a good analysis framework to kind of keep track of what you're doing. And that's one of the tools that we use here in order to see, you know, whether we are living within our means,
mm-hmm.
right? We have a responsibility to not only provide for ourselves, but to allow other people to provide for themselves simultaneously, and to allow future generations to have the resources to do the same themselves. And so this is a tool to be able to just check yourself on that process, right?
Okay.
And oftentimes, you can move on to the next one a little bit. There are people who are still stuck in this concept of the American dream and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and a whole lot of other pieces. And so this is just a reality check for a lot of folks, in that the United States is right in the middle of a pack with a bunch of other places. And so this is a study that was done that kind of indicates in the United States, on average, it takes 5 generations for someone who's in poverty to move out of poverty. That doesn't mean to move to a point where you're thriving. That means to move out of poverty. 5 generations is a very long time. So, you know, the point of trying to do your lone wolf strategy of being, you know, one of the entrepreneurs or pulling yourself up by the bootstraps is really a fallacy. And so studies actually kind of prove that also. It's working together in order to change the conditions that's going to make an impact for us. And so let me just kind of run through digital fabrication a little bit. You can kind of go down. This is what Kylie was starting to kind of refer to. And so we've been in an era where we have developed technologies that have really been almost earth-shattering. And I almost paused before I said that, but the fact of the matter is that's true, because we are, in fact, shattering the earth through the misuse of a lot of these technologies. But it's been very transformational. The first one that happened was communications. I'm old enough to remember when you made a phone call, the farther away the person you were calling, the more static you got on the line, because it was an analog line and it was subject to interference from the outside. Digital has an ability to be able to kind of correct itself. And so when digital communications came along, you could accurately communicate stuff around the world, up to satellites, down through submarines, down through cables and everything else. It created a huge difference in the ability to accurately convey information. And that was hugely transformational, because a lot of the supply chain globalization and that kind of thing requires coordination through communications. And that communications wouldn't have been feasible at this level if we're still doing it in an analog way. So that changed the world quite a bit. The next thing that happened was computation going from analog to digital. There was a point in time where computation had gears that were meshing, and it was a mechanical process to compute something. Either that, or you had a group of experts, like in the movies, who were doing the computations. But it was an analog process. When we shifted to digital computation, things were able to be done in a repeatable manner, in an error-correcting manner, and it opened the door for miniaturizing things and embedding computation in things like communications devices. And everybody's got something in their pocket or sitting beside them on the table, which is an amazing result of this conversion of communications from analog to digital and computation from analog to digital. And that absolutely changed the way we live life, the way we manufacture things, for the better and for the worse. And so we've had an opportunity to watch these actually fairly carefully and understand what the structure of these looks like. And so a key thing right now is that with the benefit of having seen those two processes going from analog to digital, we can recognize the fact that we're in the middle of a third one, which is manufacturing, materials, fabrication going from analog to digital. We're still in the process of that transformation, but we have the early parts of the emergence of digital impact on that that's happening right now. And so there was a point in time where, you know, we took a big piece of stuff and we whittled away pieces that we didn't want, or we took some clay and we put it together and shaped it into something different. It was a very analog kind of process. We're moving into digital now by having computers control the manipulation of the materials. But the end game on this is to actually have materials that have the digital codes embedded in this. And instead of having, you know, a big machine fabricating on small things, you have large things that grow out of material that has digital fabrication capabilities as an intrinsic part of the material. The first one that has a kind of blue, which is back in the mid-60s, early 70s, were the first, when they first started developing integrated circuits. They had transistors and then started putting multiple transistors on the chip. And the more transistors you put on the chip, the more capable it was. And so industry kind of started driving this process. And one of the early pioneers of this process who was tracking it noticed that there was kind of an exponential growth in the capabilities. And if you plot it on a log scale, it comes out as a line. And so every year or two, the capabilities would double on these integrated circuits. And this was only after maybe 4 or 5 years. And he posited that wouldn't it be amazing if this continued for maybe 10 years? The world would be such a radically different place, because this increased capabilities would allow you to have things that you could communicate with, that you could carry in a backpack, et cetera, et cetera. The next one kind of shows that it didn't go 5 years, this went for 50 years. And so that continued exponential growth, which is kind of shown where the green is help drive communications and computation, because it was that creating integrated circuits that can handle the communications and computation tasks. But that growth pattern of exponential growth has completely transformed the world, and it's created situations where people got caught off guard because it was expanding so quickly that we didn't have the policies in place to deal with the capabilities that kind of emerged. So the bottom one is an observation of what's happening now with digital fabrication. And the number, quantity, capabilities of the machines and the labs, that the lab equivalent that incorporates these machines, has been doubling every 18 months or 2 years for pretty consistently for a period of time. I think when we, you know, at Inside Focus kind of joined the Fab Lab network, I think we're lab 30 something. Now there are over 3,000 of them. And that was only a decade ago. And the number is still doubling about every 18 months or so. So that's kind of an indication that we are in this process of exponential growth in this digital fabrication. And that's important to note. You know, when we joined, it seemed like we were late to the game, but you look back 10 years later and now we're considered pioneers, because it's expanding so fast that if you get in the mix, understand what you're doing and start contributing, it is absolutely not too late to shape the direction and the course that this is taking. And that's one of the messages of this, is that the folks who know what this should be used for need to get involved and steering the trajectory of what it will be used for. Because if not, all these technologies always get hijacked to maintain the status quo, to have mechanisms of securing the high ground that people already have. And we'll be looking around wondering why we're on the sidelines after this earth-changing development occurred for yet another time. And the only way that'll change is if we get in the mix of this and start doing what we always do, which is to take something and turn it into something that nobody ever thought of before. There's no lack of creativity and innovation in the communities we're dealing with. What we have to do is to reach out and take these tools, which have super high leverage, and start using our finesse in innovation in this space also. When we started out, the fabrication, you know, a computer or a fabrication device was on the order of $1 million. And we had, you know, basically one of them over here and another one over there. When it came down to about $100,000, we had kind of a community level capabilities, not something that was restricted to a large government agency. And so when you had those that were able to be embedded in the community, and that's an example on the left of the computer version of this, and on the right of the Fab Lab version, like that mini computer, there were PDPs and from DEC in the Massachusetts area, and I'm from the Detroit area, so Burroughs was the one, but it was a computer that took up a whole room, or at least a good part of the room, but it didn't take up a whole building. So there are a lot of companies that got this. And so there are people who had a chance to actually work with these directly, as opposed to sliding a request into a door that somebody would run the big computer and give you results back. And when people started using the computer directly, they started creating things with it that folks had not anticipated. In this time period, we had these massive computers, there are mini computers, but they're big compared to our standards. I mean, these things are much less capable than the watches that we're wearing these days. But this is a time period when people developed word processors and spreadsheets and digital music and all sorts of different kind of capabilities. The fabrication equivalent of that is kind of almost where we are right now. The picture on the right is a typical fab lab, a few thousand square feet, a couple tons of equipment. But it's the kind of thing that you're not going to have in your backyard or your basement, but you can have in the community. And it's on the order of $100,000 or $200,000. And people can get their hands on things and start creating and innovating things that they want to create. And so it's no longer the case that you have to wait for somebody else to invent what you want. You can come up with an idea. You can go in a fab lab. You can prototype it. You can debug it. And you can make what it is that you want. So being able to innovate and create the things that you know you need in your community is a significant game changer. And being able to overlay your own ethical framework by only also critically important. So then it kind of continues accelerating. Computers, you know, when they got down to $10,000, you know, there were millions of them around. We're just entering the point where we're getting some digital fabrication down, and it's continuing to exponentially grow as the cost of the capabilities kind of comes down. And then computation has also gone down to, you know, $1,000. You got iPads and phones, and then you have billions of these. And then we have embedded electronics in a lot of things, and you have trillions of these. There's a model on the right of where digital fabrication will be going, but we're not there yet. We're kind of at the threshold between the $100,000 and the $10,000 level in digital fabrication, but we know the direction. And one of the interesting things with the fab labs is that they have gained the level of capability to be able to build the stuff in themselves. So I can have a fab lab and build another fab lab in my fab lab. And in the process of doing that, I can innovate around the equipment and create less expensive versions, more customized versions. So now the fab labs are starting to drive the process of what the next generation of digital fabrication would be, not the original manufacturers of the fabrication of equipment. So that's an idea of an area of communities being empowered to drive this forward.
It is Hard Knock Radio. We're going to stop right here and continue our conversation of the Build and Fight series, episode 5, with Kali Nkuno from Cooperation Jackson and Sister Thandi Chemaringa from KPFK, our sister station in LA, and special guest Blair. In the meantime, peace out. We will see you tomorrow on Hard Knock Radio.
listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public